Hi, Steve. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by James Dalma. He is my go-to for all things AI, neural nets, Tesla FSD. And we are on episode 25 with James. I have a playlist on my channel called James Dalma on AI. And I think this is probably one of the best resources out there to understand Tesla's AI FSD approach. We go through all the details of the hardware, the training, just all different aspects. And it's one of actually the big reasons why this past year, you know, I'm kind of, I've gained a lot more confidence just in Tesla's autonomous driving FSD AI plans, just understanding kind of the ins and outs. So highly recommend that playlist. James, I want to welcome you back. How have you been?
Great. Doing great.
Good. Are you okay looking at this crazy stock price of late?
Yeah, it's, yeah. I have these regrets that like I'm so heavily invested in it already. Like I can't really, you know, you can't buy anymore. It wouldn't make any difference if I did.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. So, but yeah, it's, anyway, like I don't really, the short-term price is not, you know, it, when you see the price go down, you're like, wow, that's a great buying opportunity. And like, I'm seeing people in my social media feed saying, hey, I bought 5 more shares. I'm like, oh, I wish I could.
Right. I'm curious do you ever share what percent of your like portfolio or net worth is in?
It's like 85% of my liquid net worth.
Got it. Yeah.
Yeah. So just like, you know, even if I get more into it, it doesn't move the dial. Right.
Yeah.
It's you get to a point where, yeah, you could, but like, what's the point? Right. So,
yeah. Yeah, definitely. We had earnings 2 days ago, and there was a ton of different things shared, I guess, on the conference call after, et cetera. I wanted to get your kind of feedback, your take on the whole, you know, FSD kind of comments by Elon, but also Optimus, and also his kind of tweets after kind of explaining stuff. There's a lot to talk about. I'm curious if you could just kind of distill something just to the highlight. Like, was there something kind of you've been thinking about the past 2 days that just has your mind kind of spinning or just trying to process it?
I'm really, I know a lot of people weren't happy with how the earnings call went. I'm just absolutely freaking delighted. Like, I think it was great. Like, it couldn't have been a better earnings call for me. I'm sympathetic to, you know, people complaining that this isn't what earnings calls are for and that kind of stuff. But, you know, I really want an unadulterated look at, you know, what Tesla's focusing on somewhere down the road, right? Not like the next quarter, the next year and that kind of stuff. Like, you know, I look at the numbers, I look at their basic operations, and I kind of feel like, you know, the next year, the next 2 years, those are, you know, Gary's term, baked, right? That's done. Yeah. Like, you can look at the numbers and you can see what the core operation is going to be, right? If there were questions about, you know, like core business things, like, you know, the biggest concern that I had about core business stuff was like, you know, how's the battery going, right? Because there's technical risk associated with ramping that battery. They had some significant new tech that was going into that thing, and it seemed pretty important to me. So I was super happy to hear that, you know, even if they don't get their 4680 plant running, that, you know, they've got enough cell supply from other places. I was really surprised to hear that they don't think batteries are going to be a constraint for them this year, right? That chips are a constraint. I mean, that kind of surprises me a little bit. You know, I would have thought that batteries would continue to be. So to me, that's like great progress on the one core thing. I'm not worried about their demand. I'm not worried about their ability to execute on any of the core business things. I'm just not interested in any of that kind of stuff. I feel like it's done. I really wanted to hear where they were going farther down the road. And I didn't expect to be able to hear that, because that isn't what the kind of stuff that normally comes up on earnings calls. So when Elon comes out and says, oh yeah, we're really serious about FSD, like that's super central, or like, we're really doing the robot like that. Like, 'cause I wasn't sure whether you and I, we talked the first conversation that we had about the robot. I don't know if you remember, my comment was like, yeah, I don't think they'll do it. They have so much on their plate. They have so many things to do. Like, they should do it. They're the best to do it. like more than anybody else. They have all the right competencies to do it. And I believe they have the right approach to doing it. But I didn't think they would. Just like, you know, I don't, you know, I that the HVAC thing surprises me. Like, it seems like the EVs are a big enough problem, you know, and solar and storage and all the other stuff. HVAC? Really? You're going to do that too? Or the VTOL jet? Like, I just don't expect those things to happen. And I would have put the robot after that, like a year ago or two. So, you know, I was super happy when, you know, at AI Day, they brought that out and they said, you know, this is a thing we're looking at. But I was thinking, yeah, it's a stretch goal. It's over the horizon, a couple years away and that kind of stuff. So to have Elon come out on the conference call and say, yeah, you know, it's the most important product development we're doing this year. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm like, they're serious. They're really serious about doing this right now. We will see how it unfolds. It's not an easy problem. In a lot of ways, I've been thinking a lot lately in watching conversations that people have about this stuff, about the parallels between like things you could say about SpaceX's business. Because in certain ways, SpaceX is a little farther down the road, right? Like thinking about, in a sense, doing the robot is kind of like doing Starship, right? You know, they built the Falcon 9. You know, and it's great. It's the best rocket anybody's flying right now. It's got the best cost efficiency. It's super reliable. I think it now has the best mission history of like any American made rocket in terms of the number of times it's flown and that kind of stuff. Well, I don't know the exact numbers, but, you know, it's a huge success. And as soon as the Falcon 9 was in the bag, they're like, OK, now we're doing Starship. Right. Which is, you know, it's just this ridiculous stretch goal when you look at the specs on the rocket. And my sense of, you know, to use that as a metaphor for what's going on Tesla, that the EV business is like the Falcon 9. You got it to a point. It's fine. It's going to be a cash cow. Everything is good there. In fact, it's going to make so much money that we can go do all these other things. And we don't really even have to care what Wall Street thinks. Because, you know, we're going to generate all the internal cash that we need to do these other efforts. And now we're going to look at these things that are over the horizon. And we're going to look at FSD, which I don't think, you know, to me, the robot, that's a ways off. Optimus is not going to happen this year, next year. Sure. But FSD, like, and then the other thing, not just Elon, but Zach, you know, sounds super confident about FSD. And they're the people to know. I mean, the only way to really know how it's doing is to be looking at the fleet-wide critical intervention data. Like, that's the metric that really matters. Because that will let you can look at that curve and you can say, you know, if there wasn't somebody in the car or if the human wasn't paying attention, like, at what point is the car good enough, even if there isn't somebody paying attention? I mean, that's kind of the line that we want to look at and the thing that we're crossing. And as an individual, you know, I've been driving FSD now for a while. I don't drive a lot of miles during the pandemic because, you know, Karen and I, we both work at home and that kind of stuff. So I'm not getting as much experience with it as I would like to. But even so, like, my sense is, you know, I see progress. Even anything an individual looks at on FSD is going to be noisy. Yeah. That is, you know, your individual experiences may not be a good indicator of what the fleet as a whole is seeing because there's so many edge cases, right? But Zach and Elon and Andre and, you know, they can look at that fleet-wide data and they will see a smooth curve, you know, over time. And they can have some confidence about, you know, because there are things on the curve that happen just because you keep turning the crank. And there are things that only happen if you do this technical thing, which is kind of risky and may or may not work out. But, you know, you work on those ideas for a while. You get a sense of how well they're going. After you've done a few of them ahead of time, you can have some confidence about whether or not, you know, given an appropriate amount of investment of time and effort, they're going to work out. And so it's not difficult for me to believe that they have access to data that would allow them to be confident. And they sound really confident and they have access to that data. And I don't think they're idiots. I don't think they're blindly rushing into something. So to hear them be confident about it and confident kind of near term, you know, next year, 2 years, like that makes me super happy. Yeah. But that sort of most excited me, like this call feels like a watershed moment. In that, you know, like I've had this fear that Tesla will like turn into a normal company. Mm-hmm. If you do startup companies, there's a tremendous, there's so much risk and it's so hard to grow. That in the back of people's minds, as they're burning away trying to get this stuff working, you've always got, you know, that there will be this goal. And at some point, you'll get to relax, right? And what happens when you get to that point at most companies is you kind of turn into a normal company, right? You stop taking big risks and you stop trying to do really challenging stuff. And you just essentially, you know, exploit the business that you have built. And for a lot of companies, that happens kind of inevitably because you hit the limit of your TAM or how big your market could be, or, you know, the opportunities for growth just they dwindle because competition shows up, like very serious competition that you have a hard time just like, you know, steamrolling. But, you know, listening to Elon on the call talking about stuff that's still over the horizon. Like, I'm like, oh, God, thank God. You know, they're not turning into a normal company. They're not going to do what Wall Street wants, which is, sure. You know, let me focus on turning in really good numbers for the next 4-8 quarters or something like that. Mm-hmm. They're still looking at, you know, like what is going to make this business, you know, take it to the next level 5 years from now, 10 years from now. And then what happens after that? So optimists are pretty far off. FSD is still... Yeah. It's going to be a little while yet before we have robotaxis running around and printing money, yeah. Right? And Gary mentioned, and other people have said that they think that there will be competition. And to me, the metaphor for that is, okay, you know, SpaceX, they landed their first booster in 2015. When is a competition coming, right? Because that's the existence proof. You know, everybody out there who makes rockets saw that rocket land. The basic formula is there. They should, and it's clear that it makes money, that it makes sense, right? It's a great idea. So where's all the competition, right? Just knowing that it's possible and having, you know, SpaceX has got smart guys, you know, but, you know, they didn't invent rockets. Why doesn't Boeing, you know, why isn't Boeing 3/4 of the way through landing something? Because it's more than just the technical chops to do it. And it's more than just an existence proof or you know it's doable, right? There's an institutional component, a cultural element that makes that stuff happen.
Yeah, like for me, I think with this earnings, like I'm sympathetic or empathetic to those mm-hmm. who are kind of disappointed with, you know, kind of Wall Street's reaction or just how the call was run. But for me, I side with you. This call was so like, I guess, I don't know. I don't know if inspiring is the word, but assuring that Tesla's ambition and innovation and their kind of goals looking forward are not slowing down. You know, it's kind of like, oh, wow. Like the biggest fear of me as an investor mm-hmm. is that, yeah, you're going to slow down and you're not going to shoot for the stars past the 5 or 10 year mark, you know, like looking out into the future, you're just optimizing for the next 1 to 3 years. That's the biggest fear I have. But to see what Elon's doing here, he's completely, you know, rewriting the whole script. And he's saying like, hey, our next 1 to 3 years, it's like done basically. Like we have all the demand.
The car thing is going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
People talk about this. I understand that people get it, but it's a really important element of this. FSD is absolutely central to the mission because Tesla can't go out tomorrow and build 5 times as many factories and ship 5 times as many cars. The battery supply is not there. There are all kinds of things that aren't there. But you know what? You can make every single car on the road 5 times more useful with FSD, right? Because the goal isn't to like drive lots of miles in electric cars. It's to stop driving lots of miles in gas cars, right? And you know, electric cars are a substitute. You put an electric car out there, takes a gas car off the road. You put an FSD electric car out there, takes 5 gas cars off the road, right? There's nothing else that Tesla could do as a company that would more you know, substantially expand their ability to get gas cars off the road than to make every car that they make 5 times as useful at getting gas cars off the road. You just can't. FSD is by far the most impactful mission thing that they could do. Just looking at the core mission of the company, right? Not even if you just, I actually think that like the, that that, you know, reducing the toll of accidents in the world, like that's a really big thing. It's incredibly expensive and incredibly disruptive to not just, you know, the US, but the whole world to have, you know, our transport system killing and maiming and destroying as, you know, as much as it does. And you know, FSD is the cure for that.
Yeah. I think the other thing is, which is interesting, is for me, I think I have a personal kind of thesis that the next 10, 20 years, like AI is going to be the most impactful kind of trend in society and technology, but also in investing as well. And to hear what Elon was doing on the call was he was basically saying exactly that. He's saying like, you know, AI is changing everything and we're just going all in with AI. We're just, this is, you know, our priority, our focus going forward.
Well, then their other core competency, aside from manufacturing.
Exactly.
Yeah. AI, right?
Yeah. And for me, like, that's what I want to hear. Like, you know, like, it's not like this vague general, oh, we like the metaverse, therefore we're going to prioritize. Like, you know, it's product. You know, it's like, we actually have a real product. We have, you know, we're working on this FSD car and then we're going to work on this FSD bot. It's not like this pie in the sky, just and it's going to take a long time or some years before, you know, obviously for the bot FSD, who knows, you know, exactly when, you know, people can just not, you know, be involved much in the driving process. But regardless, it's this whole idea that Elon is prioritizing AI. He understands the opportunity and he's pulling forward kind of the plans. And like, I'm with you. I thought the robot was going to be like a side project for many years. But for him to actually say that it's their priority for this year, it means he's really doubling down. Like he wants to put something out. I don't know when or how it's going to come out exactly, but yeah, that's what I want to see. I want to see kind of, you know, that crazy ambition to go after, the biggest, you know, trend in our lifetime.
I think, I can't remember when we had this conversation, but we had a conversation some time back where you asked me, do you think that like the stock price could move another 10x? And this was like shortly after just had a big run up. And I was like, oh yeah. And you're like, I don't know. You know, 10x, that seems like a lot. Like the world doesn't seem that big. So now I want to flip that around and ask you, you know, now that a little time has gone by. So Dave, you think it could go up another 10x?
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of one of my, I want to say hidden, but one of my motivations in interviewing you for so many episodes. I'm like, for Tesla to have escape velocity past autos, you know, like, can they really tap into the next big thing, you know, which I think is AI, and can they do it in a way that they can really take a big chunk of that, you know, value? If so, then you're looking at, you know, much more than a 10x. And yeah, I mean, I think last year for me was kind of like, yeah, it's actually, you know, Tesla can do a 10x in a reasonable amount of time, let's say 10 years or so, if they can get this right. But then with this conference call is basically, they're moving all of the pieces together, you know? And most people, especially institutional investors, they're not gonna understand it or want to, they don't even like the idea, you know, of betting big and to risk what Tesla already has. Because anything that, for example, when you bet big, when you have a different priority, like it hurts the chances of your existing kind of business, because typically you think that, oh, that could suffer.
You know, unless you take away resources. Business is such a cash cow that the bullish people are saying, oh, they'll have to be paying dividends because there's no way they could use that much money.
Yeah, yeah.
When people start making that, it's like, yeah, you know, we could finance a few side projects.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the other thing is that if you ask this question, like, will the robot work, right? And what's like, what are the chances? Just, is there anything fundamental that, you know, it can't work? And you also ask the questions like, who's in second place? What will it take for others to compete against Tesla with, you know, AI robots? All these questions. Like, I come to this place where I'm like, whoa, man, Tesla has a really, really high chance of, you know, making the best AI robot and dominating kind of this market. And yeah, I think Elon's right. It's like almost unlimited, you know, in terms of economic value that Tesla can create.
It's really hard to get your head around.
It's mind-boggling. Like the whole, like, past 2 days, I'm like, just like, oh my gosh, like, just my head is spinning. It's just like, Yeah, it's crazy.
And once again, you don't have to go, you know, I've been making this argument so long, I feel like a broken record, but you don't have to get to the robot. Like if FSD really works, it's really nuts, right? Yeah. It really is, you know, a transformative technology. I mean, it's hard to get your head around the impact that FSD has, right? I mean, we tend to think of, oh, it'll be a cheaper Uber and there'll be more of them, right? But, you know, it has implications for like how you build roads and like the allocation of real estate in cities. Like real estate in urban areas is incredibly, it's like one of the most valuable assets that we have. It, when you look at how much of it there is and what a price premium we put on it. And yet being able to get rid of parking lots in urban areas, you know, there are, there are a lot of, there are a lot of urban areas that are 60% parking lot by area, right? Like having the cars drive themselves, it completely changes that dynamic. It radically changes so many things that aren't just, you know, taxi cabs and Uber, you know, and then you have Optimus, which is 100x beyond.
Exactly.
In terms of it, it's but it's much harder to get your head around. We don't yet know what it's going to look like. We don't know what the time frame is. We, you know, the social implications, you know, you could see a lot of pushback on because it goes after jobs in a direct way that, I mean, even self-driving cars kind of do it because, you know, we see, you see the argument, what about the truck drivers? What about the taxi drivers, you know, as a component? And that, those are real concerns. But, you know, when like all of the waitresses and burger flippers and delivery people, like when all those things are on the line, I mean, the things that are just basically moving around in the world and moving objects and, you know, that's a really big deal. And so that makes it harder to have a clear understanding of what the world looks like when that thing happens. I feel like, you know, FSD is hard enough as it is to get your head around, and it's much closer in time than Optimus is. I mean,
I wrote a tweet yesterday about kind of open AI, and I was like, you know, thinking about their original mission back in 2015 to kind of have this safe and beneficial AGI development, and how there was a rift. Elon just kind of, you know, left open AI, and open AI kind of went their own direction, you know, more for profit. And my tweet was basically saying like Tesla is kind of taking the mantle, you know, to carry on the original open AI kind of mission in a sense. If they can, and I think that's probably one of the primary reasons why I think Elon wants to do the bot, because he wants to, and this is kind of my theory, which is I think he wants to make the best AI robot so he can, like, economically, business-wise, it's, I think it's a, it could be a winner-take-all or most market for the AI robot just because of the data advantage. And I think if he could create that and have the best product corner the market, there's not going to be market opportunity for others, for other so-called evil AI robot kind of potential companies to even test and to grow their market, you know? And so if he could do that, then as the dominant AI robot maker, you can then work with the government to implement the right regulations for AI. And so basically it's kind of this combination of using, you know, the best product, the best technology, but also using the business dynamics where you're funneling, you're basically sucking up all the purchasing power, you know, for that segment or category, and you're making it hard for your competitors to even have a chance. But if that works, then it actually is fulfilling the vision of OpenAI originally, which is this kind of safe and beneficial AGI. And it's interesting, actually, Elon actually liked that tweet today, which I'm like, oh, it's like maybe there is something to this, you know, where Elon was warning about AI, AGI for a long time, and he's kind of stopped that, and he's kind of doing something about it now. And I think this Tesla Optimus bot is perhaps one of the big things. I think it's his main way, actually, to protect humanity against kind of misuse of AI. What are your thoughts kind of on that?
I often, when I hear the argument about Optimus and AGI, my brain kind of gets hooked up on this thing. Technically, they're very different. Like you don't need AGI for robots, and robots aren't necessary for AGI. They seem like they get linked in people's minds a lot, but they're really two different topics. Having a humanoid robot that can, you know, do physical things that humans do in the world is a really big thing. But the other things that you can do with AI, even if you don't have AGI, like AGI is kind of a tough thing. You know, people use the term a lot of different ways. In kind of the broadest vernacular, people use it as a substitute for robots that can do anything that people can do cognitively, right? And maybe that's a fine way to do it. But there are going to be a lot of specialized AIs that perform cognitive tasks, or that leverage the cognitive tasks that human beings can do in a way that a lot of mental work that humans have done for a really long time, or that where we've been limited by what people could do. And computers they let us build models and predict the weather and, you know, run we don't have to actually crash a car. You know, we can crash cars in the computer. We can, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that computers let us do, but there's all kinds of intellectual tasks where we still need a human being to play a big role in that thinking process. And an AI is going to take a huge number of those, and we're going to have computers do them, and the computers are going to be doing them a lot better than the people were doing them before. You know, we still don't have a cure for cancer. There's all this biomedicine that is really, really hard to do. There's all of this material science. There's all kinds of physics that we still don't understand. We've been thinking about it forever. And we have, AI has the potential to make a lot of progress in a lot of fields that where people have just been pounding their heads against it for centuries because they're such difficult intellectual problems that human beings, we just don't have the capacity to do it. And we will build machines to do that. So that is going to have an impact probably bigger than I mean, it's weird. You know, we talk about FSD is so big, it's so hard to imagine what the world's going to do. And Optimus is bigger than that. Well, I'm telling you that like there's this other cognitive stuff that these AGI or beyond AGI thing. I mean, a lot of these AIs, they won't try to do everything a human being does. They'll just take one thing. Mm. We'll build a machine that just does one thing. It just does physics really well, right? Or just writes music really well, or, you know, and it'll just be super, you know, vastly superhuman in its capacity for being able to do that. And that will make a lot of sort of long things that humans have dreamed of doing for a long time will suddenly become much more doable. Those things will fall. And some of them are big, you know. Mm-hmm. What happens when, you know, you get a cure for death, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine how transformative it is to have people live 500 years or something like that. Like if you solve enough of biomedicine, or if you make regenerative medicine really work, and those are things like physics allows that, biology allows those things to happen. They're transformative in a way that just like, you know, replacing all the taxi cabs and replacing all the simple human labor isn't. They're transformative on a different domain. And AI makes all those happen too, right? They're part of the thing, but you don't automatically get those with Optimus. Optimus is kind of like the physicality of AI, putting it in the real world and letting it interact with stuff.
Well, I mean, I think that is assuming that Tesla's kind of a few things. One, that's assuming that Tesla can solve kind of this robot physical world interaction with just staying within mostly that realm. Meaning, I think there's this possibility where they're going to have to actually solve a lot of AI to be able to kind of solve this physical interaction with the world problem, and not just a physical movement, but a true kind of natural interaction of talking and problem solving with people and being useful, kind of a relational aspect too.
Sure.
So there could be this thing where, you know, Optimus, by solving for that, just like kind of like similar solving for FSD, they've had to solve for a lot more than just, you know, a narrow kind of, you know, just turning their steering wheel.
You can see Rev 1.0 is, hey, Optimus, go mow the yard. Or, you know, once a week, go out and clean the pool for me.
Yeah.
or, you know, Amazon has their fleet of package delivery robots, and they just like turn them loose and they just deliver packages, and you don't need to, you know, be a good companion in order to do that. You don't have to have good emotional response. I mean, you can just be capable in the world, in moving through the world and doing, I mean, you know, you can hammer shingles on a roof, and all you need is a body that you know how to use pretty well, and the ability to recognize objects and do that kind of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of value in just that, and just solving just that part of the problem. Like when I think about Optimus, I think of like, you know, that's what it does. I've joked in the past about how, you know, Optimus can hold your hand and console you after your dog dies. And like, I think that'll be a real thing at some point, but that's a separate capability and it's not required as like the minimum starting point. And that capability doesn't need to reside in a robot body. The capability, you know, putting shingles on a roof, that needs to reside in the robot body, right? It's got to control that. But being your best friend, or being your financial analyst, or being your teacher, you know, the person who teaches you, who gets you to your law degree, or who teaches your kids, you know, basic math or whatever the deal is, like, none of that stuff needs a robot body. It would be great if it had a robot body, and we'll probably get the robot bodies. I mean, you know, Optimus will do that, but those other capabilities, they can live in the cloud or something. Yeah. They don't need to be a resident in the body.
Yeah. I was thinking, like, actually it makes sense that Tesla expands outside of just kind of the Optimus or the FSD car. Because if you think about it, like, if they're having to solve a lot of AI to do certain tasks, it expands what they're able to do. And for example, like Dojo as a service, right? I mean, that's something that, you know, they could possibly offer neural net training as a service to others. But it's something that they just were getting good at, or are getting good at, by solving their own problems. So in a similar way, it's like, I could see it a real possibility that they solve FSD cars, they try to solve robot, but they expand into what you're saying, kind of the non-physical robot type of applications, where more of the cognitive, you know, like for example, they, I want to say encroach, but they go more into, like, for example, you know, just talking and writing and communicating and all of that, which then sets up this, I want to say epic battle, but then you have, you know, the Facebooks and Googles and, you know, OpenAIs, all these people who are just mostly online, in the online world. I think it just seems a natural progression over time that Tesla's kind of, you know, ability grows and they start to, you know, get more into that field as well. I mean, what are your thoughts?
Eventually, it's so complicated that, you know, drawing a conclusion about, oh, there will be this epic battle 20 years from now after this complicated chain encounters this complicated chain. Could they be bumping heads? Yeah, they could. Getting to scale, a lot of firsts in the AI world are going to be achieved by people who just get to scale. Like, one of the things that we know about neural networks, in particular deep learning, and a lot of the recent developments, is that we, the first time we get a new capability is once we scale some capability we already have up to some point, that we can do experiments in a particular space and we can start to understand it well. And those require a lot of computers, and they require, you know, the ability to work with really big models. So one of the ways of, you know, competing in being first at these capabilities is developing the capability to work with really big models. Like, really, I mean, not just like, you know, train my one big model, which takes 3 months, and then I get a result at the end of it. But do them, I mean, the FSD program, they're not building this giant computer, which is going to go sit in a room and think for, you know, 6 months and come back with 42, or tell you whatever give you the final neural network. They have to do it day after day after day. They retrain the model and they retrain the model and they add some things and they change some things. And so that's like, you need this factory, this computation factory, because you're cranking out this model and you're tweaking it and you're doing it again and so on. Well, being able to work at that kind of scale to investigate these really big problems is a big advantage. And that requires enormous amounts of compute capacity. And that's actually what Dojo's job is, to try to improve the economics of that. Right? Like, is there a way that we can build a machine that will take a zero off the cost of doing these models? Mm-hmm. And you know, I think there you probably can do a lot better. I mean, we've talked in the past at some length about how like GPUs actually aren't very good at deep learning models. They happen to be the best thing that we have sitting around. ASICs are a lot better, but we don't know what the perfect ASIC is. Dojo is an attempt at building the perfect, building an ASIC that's much better for the purpose of doing of training these models. Yeah. But once again, even after you've got it, you want a data center full of them. You want really big machines so you can work on these really big problems day after day after day and turn them over and experiment with stuff and figure out like how to do these really big things. So yeah, in order to do some of these grand challenge problems that Tesla's working on right now, they need to build that infrastructure. And the doing the problem teaches you to use the infrastructure. It gives you the rationale for building infrastructure. When you succeed, it gives you the money to continue expanding the infrastructure. So it's not difficult for me to imagine Tesla getting themselves into a position where they have one of the biggest chunks of infrastructure for solving these kinds of problems. And the problems, the infrastructure in the data center, it's equally good for AGI. It's equally good for curing cancer. And it's equally good for doing Optimus or FSD or the other stuff because it's generic, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the underlying techniques are common across all of these problems. So yeah, I can see them developing this huge industrial capacity for doing this kind of stuff and the expertise to use that capacity.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of crazy because, I mean, Elon has been saying for many years that he thinks like, you know, just the whole advances in biotech with gene editing, other things can be huge. You're saying curing cancer. And I think just this merging or the, you know, converging of AI and medicine, like this is going to be like the most craziest thing, I think, almost ever in a sense, just because there's so much we don't know about biology, about the body. And when we can, you know, actually bring that out and have, you know, massive, you know, neural nets computation just actually analyze this stuff, we're going to come up with the greatest discoveries in the fastest pace, like beyond probably our imagination.
There's a really interesting aspect to using deep learning in science. There have been a number of interesting papers on this going back the last 4 or 5 years, where some particular field that has a computational model that they use for trying to understand some kind of phenomenon, say the early evolution of the universe it's a field where people build models saying, well, what if the universe had this and this and that other thing, and it had this density and this matter distribution? How does it evolve over time? Does it end up looking like the universe today? Or do galaxies form? How soon do they form? How big are they? What's the statistical distribution of shapes and blah, blah, blah. And they look at, they try to figure out how it must have started in order to kind of move forward in time. But the simulations are insanely computationally intensive, right? And, you know, these are academics. They don't have like billions of dollars to do this kind of stuff. Well, people have been discovering that instead of, you know, painstakingly, you know, simulating every, you know, breaking it down to really simple rules of physics and then building this super dense grid and then evolving it forward in time, that you can build neural networks that kind of get a sense of how things evolve over time. And you can use them as this lever to do the same simulations you were doing, but do them at a tiny fraction of the computation. And there have been, some people have gone out and they have found neural networks that are a billion times faster than a physical simulator that they're working with. Recently, they've been looking like weather simulation is something that's happening. Like a DeepMind had a study recently that they did where they were using neural networks to do nowcasting in Europe, which is like, tell me what the weather is going to be for the next 3 hours in this, you know, 100 square meter area in this particular place, because it's always been a really difficult problem and it takes a crazy amount of computation. And what we found in the past is like, it takes 4 hours to run the computation to predict the weather 2 hours ahead of time. And that's not useful, right? You just never get ahead of it. But they're finding by using neural networks to shortcut a lot of these things that they can now do those simulations in 2 minutes instead of 4 hours. Like they're huge levers. So just that aspect of deep learning has the potential to revolutionize basically everything that uses physics-based simulators, which is like, it's so much of science today, right?
Yeah.
You know, and once again, if you're the guy who, you know, if you've got the industrial capacity to leverage these models, you know, that makes you a central player in this whole thing. It gives you a lot of leverage on deciding how the field as a whole evolves. And of course, it puts you in a position to profit from that stuff too, to take advantage of it as it moves forward. So yeah, I can, you know, Dojo seems to be the most kind of direct play to get for, you know, for Tesla to get into that space. But I wouldn't be surprised if they have things internal that are a lot less visible that are similarly doing that. Is that why Elon's doing it? Maybe. It's definitely a hobby horse he's had, like worrying about how this stuff evolves going forward. So sure.
Yeah. Could be. Yeah. So on Dojo, you know, Elon was emphasizing they don't need Dojo for FSD. I'm assuming kind of at a certain level. I mean, they might not need it ever if, you know, obviously the GPUs continue to improve, which they likely will. But and he mentioned kind of what you've been saying all along is mostly like a cost efficiency, you know, kind of play. But and it could be one of my viewers were saying like, hey, maybe this is a play on like not necessarily needing it for FSD, but needing it for other stuff like Optimus or like bigger ambitions, like really setting a foundation, you know, of this is going to be a long road with many like exponential growth, but to be able to have the compute power you need is going to be essential. Right. So it's kind of like one of those pieces into play. I mean, how do you see it? Is Dojo, like some people are saying, oh, it sounds like Elon isn't that confident about if Dojo is going to work. I mean, is that how you take, is that how you're saying
it? Misunderstanding that statement.
Yeah. How are you taking kind of those comments, man?
It's, okay, so, you know, Dojo's and is, you know, Tesla's not a supercomputer maker, right? And they're not in the business of making zillions of chips that they sell to tons of people. Competing against NVIDIA and Intel and, you know, Qualcomm in this space for Tesla, I mean, those are designing big complicated chips and is, you know, as a component of this whole ecosystem that does compute is a tall order. It's not something where, you know, eight smart guys, you know, work for a year and they crank it out. A big part of the challenge for Dojo is not the silicon. It's that building the APIs and the software infrastructure to make that, because it's got to slot into problems people are already doing. You got to be able to run PyTorch on it, including all the libraries, right? You want it to just drop in and you want it to scale really smoothly. You don't want to have to do a lot of complicated stuff. The reality is that stuff is complicated. There's a lot of code. It takes a lot of time to get it built and debug and get people using it so that, you know, it's like, you know, the FSD edge case thing. You know, you got to discover all the edge cases in your code. So, you know, there's plenty of potential for it to not work in the sense that, you know, once they get their system built and they've got it scaled up and they have the software working well enough that they can port an interesting set of problems to it so that it's economically useful. By the time that they've got that, that NVIDIA hasn't moved, you know, enough farther down the road. Right now, I think I said once before that, you know, NVIDIA and Intel and a lot of the players in this space who could totally do this aren't serious about it because they're trying to figure out how to do it in a way that leverages the economic advantages that they already have. And that's a big constraint. Like NVIDIA could go out and they could build the ASIC, like they could build a D1 ASIC, right? They've totally got the capability to do that, but it doesn't fit into the ecosystem products that they have right now. Like NVIDIA doing something that a startup could do, right? You know, where they have to start from scratch and they can't build on any of the software that they have kind of doesn't make sense to NVIDIA. Instead, they're trying to do this piecemeal, you know, they've got this GPU and they want to gradually morph it over many versions into something that's good at deep learning. So they're going to make progress along that line and they're going to get a certain amount of performance as they work their way down this. And they're going to try to continuously do it so that it's compatible with the software infrastructure that they have, this whole software ecosystem. How fast will that move? We will see. It's a very difficult thing to predict. So Elon is just basically realistically looking at the thing saying, you know, we got Dojo and it's going to, and we know it's got these basic hardware advantages, but we've got all this other stuff that we got to do before it's not just fast enough, but flexible enough that we can take all these jobs we want, we can drop them on, and they're running, you know, 3x faster than they are on this super mature, you know, quite capable platform that we have sitting over here. So it's a tall order for Dojo to not just to get the silicon working, but I mean, it really is. The silicon really is, in certain respect, it's a, the small part of the problem. And 90% of it is the software infrastructure, right? And, you know, and Tesla's got people that can write software, but, you know, NVIDIA's got an army of people who have been doing this for a decade, right? And so they have a lot of advantage. And not just NVIDIA. I mean, there are other players in the space too. NVIDIA's the, you know, I mean, AMD has been trying to compete with it, and AMD makes GPUs. They make incredibly capable silicon, right? And AMD has really had a hard time taking market share from NVIDIA, because NVIDIA's just got this head start on the software. Like, AMD's hardware can totally do what NVIDIA's hardware can do, but they don't have the software infrastructure, and they can't catch up because NVIDIA's not standing still. They're moving forward quickly. So I hear you know, Elon say, yeah, you know, it works if it's working well enough that the people who are using it would rather use it than use the giant GPU cluster that we have. And to me, that's like, well, yeah, obviously, right? It's hard. It's going to take a while, and you might not win. If NVIDIA was super focused, like if job wanted NVIDIA was like beat Tesla to building Dojo, they could totally do it. Like, Tesla wouldn't stand a chance. They've totally got the resources. The thing that prevents them from doing it is they've got to find a way to do it that's consistent with the business model that they have right now. And that's hard.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, that's good insight. So Elon tweeted a couple of things I wanted to get your feedback on. He said, given how hard, insanely FSD is, I think it may take 5 years or more before any company besides Tesla solves it.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, we've been talking about this a bit, like, kind of what is kind of, you know, the lead that Tesla has, but also, you know, when will other car companies solve it? Like, there's some people like Gary Black who thinks that in a couple of years, everyone will have level four, like around the same time, maybe a year later or two, you know, or 2 years later after Tesla. But I don't know, my take is like, especially having FSD beta and using it, it's just, I resonate with this assessment of how insanely hard FSD is. It's just so mind-boggling hard. And that's what makes me even more bullish on Tesla and their lead and approach. I think it's a combination. One is technically it's super hard, but then also you have to have a lot of ambition.
You have to have a million cars with cameras out there that people are driving around collecting data for you, right?
Sure, yeah.
You have to have had the foresight that you said, I'm going to spend $3,000 on every car we ship out the door, and we're just going to put these sensors in because someday they're going to be useful. Like, I will believe that other people are serious when Ford or GM or Volkswagen is shipping cars with a boatload of sensors, like an FSD compatible suite that they don't have software for yet, right? Like, they're making a big bet. This is not like some hardware I'm putting in the car and I'm going to charge the customer for it. We are going to pay for this. We are going to put it out there because even though we're going to lose money hand over fist on this for 2 years or whatever. And actually, amazingly, Tesla seems like they found a way to not lose money hand over fist on it. Like, people paid them to do it. But, you know, when I see other companies do that, I'll think that they're super serious about it. You know, I go back to the, you know, to SpaceX has been landing boosters on barges since 2015, 7 years now. Okay, where's number two?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Why can't you do it? Like, it's not because they don't have smart people. It's not because they don't have an incentive to do it, right? It's not because they don't think it'll work. It obviously works, right? So where's number two, right? Here we are 7 years, and, like, there's no number two. There's nobody who's even close there. So just the fact that it's possible for other people to do it, in theory possible for other people to do it, doesn't at all mean that somebody's going to step up and do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like it's also this angle of, for example, the intense kind of criticism that, for example, Tesla and Elon are getting for releasing, let's say, FSD beta to beta testers. Like, and they, you know, they're saying they have already like 60,000, you know, I'm like, what the heck? Where did that come from? You know, I thought it was like 5 or 10,000.
That's a got a zero I wasn't expecting, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I thought 6,000, maybe 6,000, 60,000. Oh my God, Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's the thing. It's like, what other automaker would actually have the I don't know, the guts or, you know, the craziness to release something like that? Like, they're so risk averse that like once they get to that point, they're just going to have a thousand reasons why not to push it or release it. And if you can't push it out, you can't get the feedback and you can't, you know, improve it that quickly. And so I think there's so many factors that make it really, really difficult, I think, for, you know, a typical automaker to... I said this like back in 2012, and I think it's like I said, the Model S is like, you know, 10 years ahead or 5 or 10 years ahead of the competition, right? Just in terms of, you know, its user interface and just the whole experience. And then we're 10 years, you know, after that, and it still seems like the 2012 Model S is like still like state of the art compared to anything else out there on the road, you know? I think it that type of comparison is even more like severe or more extreme with FSD because there's so much risk and things at stake. I would imagine in 5 years, I don't know, like who's going to be like really test having 60,000 vehicles with, you know, like testing level 4 on beta testers. Like, and then you can say, oh, they don't need beta testers. They'll figure it out like somewhere. Like, I don't know how they're going to do that. I don't know. I don't know. What's their hope? I mean, what's their plan?
Now I've thought, that willingness to push the envelope and like push and push. And, you know, the Model S wasn't just like an electric car, you know, had OTA updates. It was like, we're going to build the charging infrastructure. Yeah. We're not going to use dealers. You know, I mean, they just went right down the list and they're like, you know, they break every single thing. We're just going to do it all the way that it ought to be done. And we're like, maybe it doesn't work on day one. We'll do it again. We'll do it again. Cause we know it's the right way and we're going to keep doing it the right way until the right way works. And that's how I feel about the right thing to do, because it's a really important problem. We really need to solve this problem. It's really important to the world that we get the cars driving themselves and we get people out from behind the steering wheels. The right way to do this is to do it fast and push hard and be willing to, Elon, he had a tweet from years ago that I really like, which is like, it was something along the lines of like, you know, it's unethical to not do this because you're afraid of being sued. Mm. Right. Because that's kind of what it comes down to. It's not, there's no way that, you know, if Waymo was way more aggressive, that they wouldn't prevail. Like you can drag out the statistics and you can say, look, these things we're doing, they're reasonable. They are reasonable risks to take given the promise of the technology.
Yeah.
But the absolute aversion to being, you know, the villain in, you know, when your robot taxi, you know, causes injures a person has just paralyzed the industry and not recently. I mean, you know, the robotaxi companies, they've been paralyzed for 5 years and they haven't made the progress they should have made because they don't have the courage to take the knocks from a PR standpoint that you're going to do that. And the fact that Tesla's willing to do it is just unbelievably valuable advantage for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how much do you think that is partially due to Elon being on the spectrum where he's able to see certain problem solutions more, I would say objectively or more like an equation where it's like, you know, hey, more lives are going to be saved with FSD and we need to work toward that, you know, as fast as we can, going super slow and being scared of whatever, you know, lawsuits, et cetera, that doesn't make sense. You know, like it's this thing where the focus, the it's so clear to him, whereas others, it's kind of like there's so many factors and there's a lot of fears and different parties to please. And the equation is not a clear, it's not clear, you know, in their mind, other folks. But for Elon, it just seems like he hasn't wavered from this, you know, it's just very from the onset, like, this is what we need to do. We're going to do it. Very consistent. I mean, what's your take on that?
You should probably ask somebody who's not on the spectrum. Like, cause I look at it and it's like, well, yeah, obviously.
It's the right thing. It's obvious.
Like,
yeah.
Why isn't everybody else doing this? Like, I'm not confused by what Elon's doing. I'm confused by everybody else. Like, why is there one guy doing this? Yeah. Like, it's such an important problem. Yeah. We've been able to do it for a long time, right?
Yeah.
And it, you know, we just haven't made the progress that we should have made on it. Because and this, it's not, you know, this isn't the only social, societal, technologically relevant problem where we have this, issue. Yeah. Like, industry in general is really bad at taking risks that they should be taking.
Yeah.
And I don't understand it. Like, I've never understood it.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe it's a spectrum thing.
Yeah. I know, I remember you had this one tweet about something about like focusing, like being on a spectrum. Like, it's one thing that you've always been, I would say, good at, is just this extreme focus.
Yeah, Siobhan Zillis said if she could pick any if she could pick any superpower, it would be the ability to like control her focus. And I looked at that and I'm like, you know, like, I, that's something I can't turn off, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I get like, I work on something and I will collapse from hunger, right? Because I will forget to eat for 8 hours while I do it. Or like, you know, I'll be watching something on television and people will come in the room and have a conversation and they'll go do stuff. And, you know, the lights will go out, everybody will go to bed and I'll still be sitting there watching that. And I won't see any of it. Right. So it, you know, you can have too much. And then, you know, Elon's response was, I forget. He had some funny response. It was like he had a surplus attention disorder or something.
Yeah, exactly. He was basically
attention surplus disorder, right?
Yeah, he was resonating with you, saying like, you know, he has extreme focus. And when you pair that together with like not just FSD, because this, I mean, it's showing very clearly, but over the years his focus with that, but also with Optimus now, I think some people can misunderstand him if they don't understand Elon, like, oh, he's just losing focus. He's just dabbling and it's a hobby toy. Like, he's going to, you know, it's like, it's never going to work. He's just like, he's lost his mind, you know? But if you understand Elon, it's so obvious that this is like the future, that that this is the priority. You know, it's just, it doesn't even like, I don't know. It's a different level.
He probably the only public figure that I've ever heard speak where everything he says makes perfect sense to me. Like, it's just obviously right.
Uh-huh.
And like, I don't get why other people don't respond, you know, in a similar way to it. In fact, a lot of people respond in a total opposite way. But, you know, I look at politicians and I hear, like, I can't even listen to political figures like talk. I have to turn it off. It just makes my skin crawl.
Yeah.
Because they're speaking from a place that's so different from the way that my mind works that it's just, I've become intensely uncomfortable just listening to it. And maybe that's the way people respond to Elon.
Yeah. I mean, the bull case of this past or whatever, not just earnings, but recently, is you could say you take a guy like Elon Musk, who's proven himself with multiple companies launching rockets, you know, reusable, making EVs, being the forefront in, you know, like, you know, the autonomous car race, et cetera, all these accomplishments. And you basically have him, his mind and his focus concentrated, activated on like these, on the next kind of 10, 20 year biggest kind of evolution or change in technology, which is AI and the convergence of, let's say, robots. And how can that not be bullish for Tesla? You know, it's like, I don't understand.
It's the most bullish thing ever.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
what are you talking about?
Yeah, if everyone had the mind of, let's say, you or me, the stock would be like, you know, like shooting up. It obviously,
or, you know, not. I mean, there's it's not like there are no risks. I mean, Elon himself is, you know, frequently talked about how, you know, we almost went bankrupt, and I am often much more confident that they will succeed, or SpaceX will succeed at something that they're doing, than he appears to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but then I get the, if when you work in a technical domain and your job is to solve this really complicated problem, you spend all your time thinking about everything that could go wrong. It was Eric Berger, I think it is. He writes for Ars Technica So he had this, he talked about how he really didn't expect the JWST to work, right? You know, they had this super complicated deployment thing with like all 700 sequential single point failures or some, maybe it was 170. It was like some huge number. And he, you know, he talked to all these people over the years who worked on the project, and they're all engineer, and they're like, oh my God, there's like no way this is going to work. Like there's so many things that could go wrong or whatnot. And, you know, of course it worked. Right. It, you know, it's we send raw. I had a friend who he designed landing systems for rovers that got sent to Mars. Right. And talking to him about like the stuff that could go wrong is just like so pessimistic. You know, it's like, we got to get this wrong. And it's and a lot of the problems they're dealing with are just you can't simulate. Like he's got to use these hypersonic wind tunnels to test, you know, tungsten carbide heat shields. You know, nobody's ever built these before. We're going to put one on a rocket. We're going to send it to Mars and it's going to work on the first try. You know, it just doesn't sound very likely. And yet they do. They do work out. So what's with this disconnect between technical people who are deeply embedded in the thing that it seems like they should be the people who have the best insight into whether the thing will work. But you find when you talk to these people, when you work with these people, and when you have done that yourself, that the act of working on these really complicated problems makes you very pessimistic about how things will go. I mean, it, you know, as an outsider, you can look at this. I would have these problems where I'd just be in the middle of, you know, at work, and I'd just be buried in this thing. I'm like, God, this is never going to work. We got to get this to work. We got that to work. And my boss would be standing over here in the hall like, 6 weeks will be fine. And he would be right. You know, I'd be there just pounding my head on the desk like, there's no way this is going to work. I just can't see how it's going to. But he had seen it happen a bunch of times externally. And, you know, I should be the expert. I'm the guy doing the problem. And he's standing in the hallway looking at me saying, like, you did this 3 months ago. It was the same thing. Right. It'll be fine. Relax. So sometimes I think that that's what's going on. You know, yeah. Elon seems super pessimistic because, like, he's the guy chewing glass and staring into the abyss. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's not a, you know, a feel good kind of position.
Yeah, definitely. One of the other tweets from Elon was in response to solving the money problem, Stephen Mark Ryan, where I think Stephen Mark Ryan was talking about how, you know, OEMs, they're in a predicament because let's say Tesla is like FSD is 10 times safer. And then their, you know, package is like not even as safe as a human driver. What are they going to do? And Elon replied saying that Tesla will support FSD licensing to by other manufacturers. I thought this was a big statement by Elon. He actually is publicly kind of committing or opening that up. I don't know if he's done that in the past, like this direct. Maybe he said they'll be open to it. But this is like actually saying they will. They are going to do it. So I was like, whoa, this is actually... Like, I mean, what's your take? Like, is this,
Of course they will.
Like, they will, of course.
It's the same thing. Like if you'd asked me 6 months ago, maybe we did. I could have swore we talked about this. And I was like, they'll license it.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's the right thing to do. I was speculating, thinking recently that, you know, being mission focused, you could go to Ford and say, we'll license it to you for a nominal fee, but only for use on EVs. So please build more EVs, right?
Uh-huh. I mean, how do you think this licensing agreement could work with other OEMs? I mean, would you do something like monthly subscription and Tesla takes, you know, what, half or 70%, the OEMs take 30% or something? Of the monthly subscription fee or
it's whatever. Elon had a great line, speaking of Elon's lines again, where he's, somebody was asking about like, it was the FSD pricing. And this is on a couple of conference calls back. And he said, whatever price we come up with at first, it'll be the wrong price and we'll iterate on it. And that's how I feel about it. The reality for these pricing stuff is that pricing creates all these complicated incentives for all the different players. And it's difficult ahead of time to predict what they are. So you make a guess and you go at it and then you see how the market responds to it. And then you adjust your pricing in order to end up with the incentives that you want for all the players. In fact, I think that's the toughest thing with trying to understand how the robotaxi, you know, sort of model is going to work out. I've tried to do this exercise on paper where, you know, it's like, what if you do this pricing model and you do blah, 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 and you sort of work out what it looks like. And then you think about the secondary effects and how they interact with one another and all the other people that come in. And it's just really hard to figure out what the right pricing model is for anything. My sense that Tesla will do it, I mean, there's a bunch of good reasons for Tesla to license the thing. One thing is, you know, they can't make all the cars they can sell. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's going to change for quite a while, right? So it's not like licensing it to somebody, licensing FSD is going to significantly, it's going to have a big negative impact on how many cars they can sell. I just don't think it will. And, you know, to the extent that it does, you price it accordingly so that you're being compensated for whatever your loss of sales are. The other thing is, in much the same way that they made AP standard on cars, once it became clear that it was safe, I think it's going to become really clear really quickly that having FSD on cars is, it's a good, it's a humanistic good, right? We want it on lots of cars because it will save lives. It's like, was that Volvo invented the seatbelt and they didn't put a patent on it because they wanted everybody to be able to do that. And in a similar kind of vein, like to be a good corporate citizen, to be a good human being, you know, something that saves lives, you want people to have it. And I, my sense of Elon is that he would find a way to make that happen because I think he'll see it that way. He'll see like, you know, we don't want the only safe cars to be our cars. We want all the cars to be safe. We're going to make safe cars. We're going to make the safest cars that we can. But we're not going to try to make it so that Ford can't make a safe car because we want a competitive advantage. That would be scummy. We're not going to do that. And that's what FSD is. You know, it's in a lot of ways, it's a super important safety feature.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. Like, who do you think would take Tesla up on this offer? I mean, I would imagine that some of the OEMs might be reluctant because Tesla's a competitor. They think that this would benefit them. And there's this like, you know,
it's like with the supercharger network thing.
Yeah.
Right? It's, I think that, you know, I think Elon had said a long time back, you know, we will let people use the supercharger network, but they have to do all the work. We're not going to slow down our deployment of superchargers or change the design of our cars or whatnot. Like if they do all the work, they can use the system. And I, you know, my experience with sort of corporate, you know, competitor dynamics and stuff is they don't want to do that. Right. And, I mean, you have a relationship with a supplier and they do what you ask them to, cause you're paying them to.
Right.
And you know, relationships with competitors are frequently, you don't do anything with them that you can avoid. And so, you know, for, you know, General Motors to want to use Tesla's supercharger network, it doesn't fit in either of those categories. Yeah. I mean, Tesla is not going to say, well, yeah, oh yeah, we'll be your supplier. We'll take all these engineers off these things we want them working on and we'll have them solve technical problems for you instead. And the flip side, you know, the engineers at GM are, you know, may not want to design their cars around a bunch of stuff that Tesla did at the same time. So I could see it being problematic.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense because it seems like most of the auto OEMs, like, yeah, it's basically them and their suppliers, you know, and then the suppliers, like you're saying, yeah, you just hire them to do something. They provide the parts and you put them together. But once you add this competitor/, and it's not just a simple part either. It's like, you would have to add it seems like you have to redesign the car in terms, you know, with camera placements,
Now, I would expect Tesla to say, look, the simplest thing to do is for you guys to put the same cameras on your car in the same places that we put them in. It won't be exactly the same. They'll have to tweak it some, just like the Cybertruck won't be just like the Model 3. You know, we need the right number of cameras. We need to be able to integrate them. We want to be able to drop it into the suite of software we're already building. We don't want to have to spin up a whole another AP team to go off and develop a product for you. We want you to use to the greatest extent possible the product we're already making. If you do that, we'll make it easy for you.
I mean, but it seems like pretty complex because you have to put the FSD computer in, put in all the cameras, the wiring, but then you need this, like, you need the display, but then the display isn't that simple because you're, you know, it shows a lot.
The UI doesn't, I mean, the UI, you could, like, Ford can put their own UI.
Really?
They can get Bosch to design one. I don't think that's it. Okay. So I don't know if you know this about the architecture right now, but, you know, if you turn off the MCU, if you turn off all the displays in the car, the computers, like, running those things, if they cease to operate, AP doesn't care. It just keeps going. And you can do this. And I've done it many times.
That happened.
Get in the car,
today.
Go drive FSD around and reboot your MCU.
Yeah, actually,
it'll just keep driving.
Yeah, no, that happened to me today. It was crazy. Yeah. Like the MCU like blacked out. And it was like the first time this happened to me, like maybe 3 years. But I was on autopilot FSD and it just kept on going. You know, whole screen's out.
That's because there's a separate fail safe machine that just does autopilot, and everything that's critical to autopilot is inside that box. So, you know, that box, to a first approximation, you know, if GM wanted to use it, they'd need that box. They'd source it from Tesla. They'd use the same thing with the same silicon, whatnot. They buy the same cameras from the same place. And then whatever user interface you want to put on it, I mean, you could write that separately, and Tesla could give you an API into the box. And that probably wouldn't be super hard to do.
Over the air updates, I mean, how would that work?
Yeah, so I suspect that like that would be a big sticking point, because I think Tesla wants that data to continue improving the system, and that GM would have a massive apoplectic allergic reaction to the idea that Tesla was going to be pulling data off of all their customers' cars. They wouldn't. I mean, you know, so my understanding is like that was a big part of the problem that led to Mobileye and Tesla splitting up in the first place, right? Was that fight over that data. And you know, my understanding of Mobileye's relationship with the car companies that they deal with is that's a central tenet of the deal that they cut with car companies, is that we need that data. We want that data. It's super valuable, and people will fight over it.
Yeah.
And I think Tesla will want it, and I think they'll probably insist on it. And I can imagine that being a really big problem for auto OEMs.
Yeah, that makes sense. Zach Kirkhorn at the earnings call, he was talking about like software revenue, and in the earnings shareholder letter, they're also saying, like, I think twice, for the first time that I've noticed, they're talking about acceleration of software revenue, or, you know, and it seems like they're starting to kind of, I don't say wake up, but alert people that this is going to be a big part of their business eventually. We're going to start seeing software revenue. And it seems like it's together with this theme of their growing confidence in FSD.
Software revenue is FSD.
Yeah,
right.
Basically,
like, what other software? They're not charging for games, right?
Yeah.
It's not like there's a fee for using your web browser or something like that in the car, right? I guess they do have the, you know, the premium whatever thingamajig, but that's not really software. That's really a connectivity thing.
So how do you see this playing out in the next, let's say, 1 year or 2 years? Because some people will say, I've used FSD beta and it's buggy, and, you know, I don't think it's ready for prime time, and I don't think, you know, Tesla's even close. And they're touting all these achievements, or, you know, they're almost close, but I'm not seeing it.
Valid criticisms, I would say.
Yeah. But yet the management is all like, you know, touting this like imminent I guess milestone of so-called solving FSD
happening this year since 2016.
Yeah. So what's going on with this? You know, why are we seeing
this? It's
hard.
It's really hard. Right. Yeah. But you know, you look at it and it doesn't look that, you know, it looks like you're making good progress. I think I've said before that one of the problems is we don't know, you know, you can plot that curve. Here it is getting better, but where's the line where now it's good enough? Like, we don't actually know. You need an existence proof to know that. And, you know, but there's a really interesting thing that happens in this space right now, because progress is so fast, is that things that look super far away, they turn out they're not really all that far away. And like the day before or the week before, you know, when DeepMind did the AlphaGo thing, when they started working on AlphaGo, they thought, you know, they weren't at all confident that it was going to work, right up to the day that they went and they, you know, and they played against a top pro. They weren't confident it was going to work. They didn't know. Right. They, you know, they had all these reasons to believe that it wasn't going to do that. And only just a few weeks before, a few months before, it wasn't working nearly as well. They had all kinds of problems with it. Right. And then, you know, it went from being, you know, better than a decent pro to better than a really good pro to like freaking godlike, like so good. Jan LeCun had a great line in an interview that I heard the other day. He was talking about how Go players, like pro Go players prior to AlphaGo, right? They had thought that they were maybe within a couple of stones of playing a perfect game. You know, it's called two stones from God or three stones from God. It's like describing somebody who's really, really transcendentally good Go player is that they were so close to playing a perfect game. And now we know, because we have a Go God, we know that you guys, you're not within 20 stones of God, right? I mean, like, that's how good, how much better it was. Right. And so, you know, and that happened in no time at all. You know, just like literally a few months before they did it, the consensus of experts was it was a decade away, if ever, that Go would be. And then it just happened, right? So stuff happens fast in this space right now. We're deep learning is new. We're constantly being surprised by what it can do. I think one time I sat down like 2 years ago, and I went back to the last few years, and every single year since 2012, a major breakthrough had occurred that the overwhelming consensus of experts the year before would have been that's not happening for 10 years, right? Every year we got one of those for like 7 years in a row. So yeah, it can look super far away and then be here, right? Yeah. Really quickly. It's not like building a bridge, you know, where you look out your window every single day and they've put in 50 more bricks and you can see where it's going to go. These things, they can happen really, really fast. But, you know, similarly, the lack of predictability means that you can predict it. You know, if you're an optimist, you can look at that thing and see it happening this year and be wrong and be wrong again next year. Yeah. Elon's not the only person to be wrong about. You know, Waymo used to, or before it was Waymo, when it was Google's self-driving car thing, like, they frequently made predictions about how soon they would have self-driving cars, you know, and they were wrong. And that was 10 years ago. So,
I had someone comment on in one of my videos saying that he's a software developer and he's seen AI is not progressing very fast. So therefore Tesla doesn't have much chance, right, with FSD. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was kind of, you know, FSD is progressing super fast, you know, with especially in the fields that have like the right data. Because I think what's difficult to track with AI,
people who measure it are shocked at how fast it's going. But people's impression, if they're not measuring it, is not much is happening.
Yeah, because like there's a lot of parts of software development where you just don't have, let's say, the data and the right kind of, you know, thing where neural nets are completely, let's say, revolutionizing your field. And so therefore you're doing your thing. So you're not seeing AI, but then in the fields that have, let's say, not just the massive amounts of data, but the right type of data and the right applications, you're seeing these crazy, you know, crazy movements of improvement. Like for example, you bring up Go, like reaching that point was a big accomplishment, but now we look back and it's kind of like, I don't know how many times better is, you know, like the top neural nets than a Go player right now. It's like, I don't even think it's like you can.
Humans can't even understand the games anymore, right?
Yeah, it's like you can't even put them in the same like comparison level. That's how fast, you know, like.
It'd be AI like you're playing against a dog, right? It's just a whole different level.
Yeah. It's such an interesting field because like you can actually, so controversial. Some people are saying, hey, it's not happening. You know, AI is bogus.
You know, that's what they said about progress against the Go problem, like right up in the OSB too. So you know, things look like that. It looks like nothing's happening. I worked in the speech recognition back in the 90s, right? Speaking of ancient history. And, I looked at how fast we were making progress in speech recognition back then, like all through the 90s and then into the 2000s, speech recognition just got better and better and better and better and better. Like you could look at the metrics and like if you tried to measure error rates and that kind of stuff, it just got better and better and better. But the perception of everybody that I talked to who was outside the field, and most of the people in the field too, were pretty pessimistic about it because we kept thinking that like next year is going to be the year where like the elevators and the cars and you'll be dictating everything and we'll get rid of keyboards, will be a thing of the past. Like we all thought that stuff was going to happen and it just didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, it had to cross a certain threshold before it became really useful to people. And you know, we looked at it and it looked like that threshold wasn't that far away. Like we were in the lab and, you know, the people who knew how to use this stuff, we could make it. I worked on and built, I have one down in my garage, a navigation system for cars, which is completely voice interactive. And I was a lead engineer on the hardware side of this thing back in the late 90s. And it works. Like I can plug this thing in my car and it can give me voiced instructions to like drive around Los Angeles. And you talk to it with these one word commands and it works great. 20 something years ago, right? But everybody that I talked to thought voice recognition didn't work. And it kind of didn't work because it didn't go mainstream until like your mom could use it. And yeah. You didn't need any instructions and that kind of stuff. And today there's still lots of people who have difficulty with it. Yeah. So, you know, knowing when you're going to cross that threshold where it goes big is tough for people inside the field, excuse me.
Yeah. I think my kind of, I would say concern or caution is with driving, it's like this life and death matter. Like one mistake, 1 second can lead to this fatal crash, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so in order to, I think there's three stages. So first stage is like, you know, FSD is kind of more of a pain than help. And it's still, you know, I thought that was, you know, Tesla has crossed over that. They're in this, I think this so-called, what I call a second stage where it's mm-hmm. getting to be a point where it's very valuable. It's super helpful to the driving experience where like right now I turn on FSD beta almost everywhere I go. It's just like more relaxing, just like how AP on highways, it got to this point where you're just like, wow, you know, I can't imagine driving a long, you know, road trip without autopilot, right? That would be the pain. And I think, FSD beta is starting to get to this point where like, wow, this is actually super helpful for me.
A big chunk of that is you getting used to it and getting comfortable with it, right?
Well, actually, yeah, I think so. But I think there's different factors. One is you need the right type of drive, like for like where it actually is like, it is not nerve-wracking. For example, in California, like there's certain parts of where I was driving and how it wouldn't cross over into the bike lane at the corners and all this stuff that made it more of an anxious experience. But here in Austin, it's like drives great. And then I've got this like kind of 5 or 10 minute like residential piece to our house where it just is so easy. It's just like it adds a whole another level of value. And so I think we're in the second stage where it's just getting better and better. It'll add more and more value, kind of like autopilot on the highway. The question though is, when will it jump into the third stage where autopilot on the highway hasn't gotten there yet, where you're like, okay, I'm okay with, you know, just sleeping for 30 minutes, you know, and letting the car drive or something. And there are going to be some people who are risk takers who take that bet and say, you know, I trust
there it. Already are.
Yeah. But, I think the vast majority of people, the common sense is if I drive together, if I oversee this, you know, thing together, then it'll be vastly more, I say, safer than just maybe this thing driving or me driving, you know, at least right now. That's what I guess the thinking is for people. So that's my question mark. It's kind of like, yeah, I mean, sure, theoretically in a year, I mean, maybe it's possible, but it just seems like it's further off where it could jump into the life and death type of, I don't know, safety level where you're okay with that. I don't know. I guess, you know, what you're saying too is like, it's hard to know when that jump is or that, you know, capability is going to be realized because, it's hard. I'm looking forward. Yeah.
The perceptual capabilities of the system. Like if perception was perfect, mm-hmm. you might not be able to make a system that, that drove in a completely non-annoying way, but you could make a system that would drive in a perfectly safe way if perception was perfect. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can do this because we can, you can do the thing in video games, right? Where you create a controller for a car in a video game and it has perfect perception because the computer knows where all the other rendered objects are and that kind of stuff. And so guaranteeing that you have safety margin for all your maneuvers against anything that any of the other dynamic objects in the system or static objects will do, you can, you know, that's something you can guarantee. And as the perception system in FSD gets, you know, arbitrarily good, mm-hmm. it will become possible for it to drive with an extremely high level of safety, although it might be annoying. And Google actually, they went through this phase too. When they first started running their systems around their cars around Mountain View, right? The initial setting, like, because they had really good perception working at that point in time, but they kept getting rear-ended, right? Because the cars are just conservative in how they were moving, and so they kept having all these little fender benders because they didn't play well with other cars. You know, humans like to drive with negative safety margin and, you know, very, very tight tolerances and anticipating what other people are going to do. And the, you know, Google's first version of the car wasn't smooth in that way. And the humans around it didn't, you know, respond appropriately. And so they constantly had these little issues. So, you know, FSD could, I don't think FSD will go that route. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they'll try to stay smooth because they want the short path to, you know, having a system that actually you can use in the real world, and you're not going to have a lot of little fender benders, even though you're being perfectly safe, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
They'll, you know, you'll have to, you know, Elon has made the joke about Mad Max mode. You have to have it in LA. Yeah, I mean, you can't drive with zero risk of having an accident in LA. And it's kind of true. It's sad, but it's really true. Like, you can't get where you're going if you drive conservatively enough, because nobody else is, and they kind of don't tolerate you doing that. So, you know, I think Tesla will probably take that route with FSD, and it'll be a little harder to do. But, you know, if your perception system is really good, you can definitely put an upper bound on how bad the accident could be, right? They could definitely end up with a system that has a non-zero chance of having fender benders, but has a zero chance of killing you or killing anybody else.
Got it. Huh. Interesting. So kind of mitigating, I guess, the accidents, that could happen.
As the perception gets better and better, mm-hmm. And you know, the big changes that we've seen, the big extensions that we've seen them adding to the system, they're all about perception right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, planning and whatnot, it plays some really important roles too, but getting perception really, really rock solid. Like, they're not there yet. Mm-hmm. And they need to get there, and I think they will get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. It seems like they're, I guess this is my question too, is from the earnings call. They had a lot of confidence that they could sell like high priced cars, or current level for as long as into the future, it seems like, because,
why would you make a $25,000 car?
Yeah.
It's like, you sell the $25,000 car after you've sold all your $50,000 cars. Right? Yeah. And when is that going to happen?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, really, when is that going to happen?
Well, my question, I guess, with this is, there's two ways I see it. One is FSD could add kind of gradual, it gets better and better, adds value, more value over time. So people, the take rate kind of goes up, therefore it kind of props up that the average selling price for the vehicle, let's say to current levels, let's say 50,000 per car or something. So that's one scenario. The other scenario is like, and it seems like Elon has been insinuating this more. It's like there's going to be a level, a place where the switch gets turned on, you know, where like the asset value just goes up, like once the car can drive itself.
It's not going to be an overnight thing.
Yeah,
it's a nice way to talk about it. And it's a relevant way of talking about it. Mm. Because from, you know, the thing is, if it happens over the span of a year, 2 years later, you're going to look back and it's going to seem like it happened overnight, because the world the world couldn't keep up with it anyway, mm-hmm. whether it happens overnight or over 3 months or over 12 months, right? It's still going to seem virtually instantaneous. You know, if you've got 3 million cars out there and you're getting 3 million cars worth of utility out of them, and 12 months later, you're getting 15 million cars worth of utility. And it was like, you know, 10 million cars just came out of nowhere worth of utility.
Yeah.
So that it will feel instantaneous. Yeah. I mean, it will feel like it happens really fast when it happens.
Yeah. Because it seems like, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Like, it seems that the Tesla manager is very confident that I don't say worst case, but like the base case is that FSD is improving so fast, it'll add this, you know, high value increasingly over time that supports, you know, the average, you know, sale price of the car. Therefore, the need for a cheaper model, really, they're not seeing it right now. I mean, is there a risk though at all with that thinking? Like, if it doesn't improve as fast, and, you know.
Yeah, of course, there's a risk if it doesn't improve as fast.
Yeah.
Right? So, how, like, you know, when Elon's on the call saying, I don't think you understand right, what I'm saying here. He's speaking from a place of being really confident. Now, you can believe he's a confident fool, and many people do.
Yeah.
Right. I think they're, he and Zach and the people inside working on that thing, they're in a better position to know than we are. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't think they are fools. If you're not optimistic, you don't try. Right. So optimism is going to be a necessary characteristic of anybody who succeeds at these things. Yeah. But you can't be an idiot and succeed at the same time. Yeah. I mean, you can't just have completely unrealistic expectations. You make your best guess based on the best data that you have, and it says something, and you go with that. And sometimes your best guess is still wrong, even though it's the best data that you've got, because it's not perfect and there are unsolved problems still here, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe it doesn't happen this year. Maybe it doesn't happen next year. Those possibilities are on the table. I think that the demand for the cars that they make right now is really underestimated. Mm. They've been raising prices and it's not difficult for me to believe that they could get Austin up and Berlin up and be cranking out Model Ys at the limit of their capacity and not satisfy worldwide demand for the Model Y for years. So that just takes all the urgency off of making a car. The point of the $25,000 car is to make a cheaper car to deal with flagging demand for the cars that you're making right now. Tesla had gone through an event where they made relatively conservative assumptions about what they thought they could sell as far as Model 3s. And then when they actually got the car out there, they discovered the demand was much greater than they thought it was. And I think in the last year, they've gone through the same thing, but with the whole EV market, right? They've discovered that the actual tappable demand for the cars that they make is substantially in excess of the upper bound of what they had planned for before. So now they have a new reality. They thought they were going to be able to make a certain number of Model Ys at a certain price and 3s at a certain price and sell those. And that if you wanted to continue ramping your volume, you were going to need a $25,000 vehicle. And what they're finding, looking at the thing, is they were wrong. They can actually sell a lot more of the expensive vehicles before demand starts flagging. And confronted with that reality, you don't make the $25,000 car. You're like, we don't need it for a year or two. So we're not going to work on it for a year or two. And the other thing that, if you think FSD shows up in that window of time before you get the $25,000 car, that also really changes the calculation, because all of a sudden, all of the $50,000 cars that you're making or selling, they're now worth $200,000 or something, I mean, you, once again, you're back in the, Elon's words were, we will be able to sell every single car we can possibly make, right? And like, if that's what your data is telling you, yeah, you don't waste manpower designing.
Awesome.
Still connection problems.
Yeah, some connection problems. But yeah, James, it's been awesome catching up after earnings. Very, very helpful getting your feedback and thoughts on Elon, FSD, Optimus, competition, everything. It's been fun. I'll go ahead link to your Twitter profile in the video description. Also the playlist.
I got James nothing to Dama. Promote.
Yeah, exactly.
We're just here having fun.
Yeah, exactly. So. But yeah, definitely. I'm looking forward to some more talks. I just feel like when I look at the past year, like our talks on AI have just been really valuable, and I want to have some more talks. So hopefully we'll see what we could do.
Okay.
If you're open to it.
Happy to oblige.
Okay, cool. All right. Thanks, James. I'll see you.